Welcome to Ufahamu Africa, a podcast about life and politics on the continent. I'm Kimmy Dion, your host. This week's episode was produced by non-resident fellow Takondwa Sempere. Together with her colleague Keith Mundenge Fufu, they reflect on their experiences in African education systems in Southern Africa. They also talk about how those experiences and what they've learned since inform their current work as secondary school educators in South Africa. I love their conversation not just because of the broad range of themes they discuss, but also because it feels like you're sitting right there with a couple of friends having fun but serious conversation about how things are and how they should be. Their discussion also brought to mind a classic work, Ngugi wa Thiong'o's Decolonizing the Mind. If you haven't read it, it's not long and it's quite powerful. I recommend finding a copy at your local library or bookstore. Before we go to Takondwa and Keith's conversation, I want to remind our listeners about Ufahamu Africa's student essay competition. We look forward to reading your one-page reflection essays on topics related to life and politics on the African continent. Learn more on our website, ufahamuafrica.com. All student essays submitted by May 1st, 2023 will be considered. Now let's hear from Takondwa and Keith.
Welcome again to Ufahamu Africa. I am Takondwa Priscilla Sempere. I am from Malawi and I'm super excited about today's episode. For this episode, I chat with a dear friend of mine and fellow educator. He is a teacher at the School for Ethics and Global Leadership in their Johannesburg campus, and we talk together about school culture, reflecting on our childhoods in educational systems in Southern Africa and how it informs our praxis as educators.
All right.
So introduce yourself. Who are you? Who are you to me? I'm kidding. Who are you? What's your name? Where are you from? Where are you local, if you want?
Hi, Takondwa.
Hi, Keith.
I am Keith Mdenge Fufu. By nationality, I'm Zimbabwean, and where I'm local to, I would say Johannesburg, I would say Cape Town. Slowly and interestingly, Harare. Mm-hmm. So I think those are some of the places I'm local to. And I am currently an English teacher and an ethics teacher, although I think I identify more as an English teacher.
We love an
English teacher. And currently I'm based in Johannesburg, and that is where I teach. And that's me. You know, I really think that it's such an important conversation to have, particularly for people who went to school on the African continent and are now back in schools on the African continent in one way or the other. Because when I talk to my brothers, there's a way we normalize, like, Zimbabwean, a particular kind of Zimbabwean school culture. And when I talk to other people who haven't gone through that experience, and often who are not from the continent, there's a lot of shock. There is a lot of, like, you know, gapped, you know, mouths, and people are just like, oh my God, what? And, you know, people are just looking at you and they're like, no, that could not have happened. Right? So I think what interests me is how, when I talk to someone like you from Malawi, or I talk to my brothers, or I talk to people from South Africa, they're like, yeah. Or even people from Nigeria, they're like, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then they'll give you a story. Like, we're trading stories of the wildness, but we're not calling it a wildness. We're just like, yeah, girl, same, you know.
We're like, yeah, so they lined us up and they caned us in front
exactly.
of everyone.
Exactly. And then you're like, no, but then they were making us dig trenches in the sweltering heat. Or, like, you know, I remember one of my friends, this happened to her, where they had this, you know, those rocks that they have, like, lining, like, an entryway.
The gray ones. The ones from the quarries.
The quarries, yes. Right? And they would make you kneel on that for, like, hours as punishment. And then people are just like, oh yeah, this used to happen. Like, oh my God, you know? Mm. And sometimes people have scars, like literal scars on your body, right? About, oh, this teacher hit me here. Mm. Or like this punishment from a prefect. And we are like, oh yeah, that's what we do. And sometimes if you're like some of the people I know, you say, oh, but we turned out all right. You know? Mm-hmm. And I think that part is the part that I'm most interested in resisting as a teacher and as a person, right? Mm. Because we turned out all right doesn't make it all right.
It doesn't.
Right? And I think we try to console ourselves by saying, oh, we turned out all right. But I think by doing that, we're also leaving room for possibility for us to replicate some of those dynamics or some, like to propagate some of that culture, right? And so I think for me, that's why I'm very interested in like this topic, because we really need to... We need to talk about it.
Yeah.
We need to... There needs to be a collective, like, secondary school kids assemble and let's really talk about what happened.
Let's heal! Because what you're saying about how normalized it is real. I mean, it's real not just in the context of this conversation about education and school cultures, but I think generally when people have grown up in traumatic environments or... difficult situations, if you know nothing else, it's very easy for you to just be like, oh yeah, that happened. Yeah. But it's not right that it happened, and we need to like confront it and talk about it. So tell me about your schooling. I'm particularly interested in secondary education because that's what we teach, and I think that's what I want us to discuss today. So tell me about what that experience was like for you as a student.
All right. So I had a high school experience that I don't think was common to my family and also like people around me. So I went to a secondary school. So maybe I can start, let me take a step back and let me explain the schooling system in general, in broad strokes, that is in Zimbabwe.
Mm-hmm.
So in Zimbabwe, you have what I think are three kinds of school, secondary school options. You can either go to a private school, and a private school is not governed by some of the policies that other schools are, and they can write, for example, Cambridge A-levels instead of writing the Zimbabwe secondary exams, ZIMSEC. That's one type of school. The thing about private schools is in general, they are the most expensive kind of secondary education to access. There are tiers, of course, within that system, and I'll come back to that. The second kind of secondary school you can go to is a mission school. So in Zimbabwe, because of colonization, there are a lot of schools that were started by missionaries dependent on their denominations.
Right.
So some of them are Catholic, some of them are Anglican, some of them are Methodist, etc., etc. These schools, over time, and I think even still today, are renowned for taking students based on academic merit.
Right.
So when you write your primary school leaving exam, if you do really well, you can place into a really good, academically speaking, mission school. And my brothers went to this kind of school.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other option that you can take are schools that I would call government schools.
Mm-hmm.
And these are schools that are located in the city. They're located in any place where people are gathered, and they are schools that are not neither mission schools nor the private schools, and they're just serving the communities that they are built in.
Right.
And sometimes they are being subsidized by the government, and sometimes they're not.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So this is the kind of landscape that I grew up in. I went to a low-tier private school. It was still expensive for my family, but compared to the other private schools that exist in this consortium of schools, it was rather on the lower end.
Right.
What that meant was the private schools are usually associated with having like white kids and like colored kids and Asian kids. So, or East Asian kids. We didn't have any of that. At my school, it was majority black. And yeah, I don't even remember don't think there were any white people, to be honest.
Count them on one hand.
Yeah, like, truly. And teachers and students, right? Mm-hmm. And so what that also meant was the culture that was present at the school wasn't a culture you would expect, quote-unquote, from a private school.
Right.
So it was the kind of school where caning happened.
Mm-hmm.
There was a very, very, very strict and clear hierarchy of power. You know, if you were in Form 1, which is like entry level high school, 13 years, you are the lowest of the low.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in Form 6, you're 18, you're doing A-levels, you are the most powerful student. You know, and that's how it worked.
Right.
And then the teachers were the kind of like executioners. They were the people who, you know, could do as they please to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And if you looked at them the wrong way, it was, you know,
over for you,
girl. But at my school, only the principal and the vice principal and this other man who taught like design and technology were allowed to cane you, but the other teachers were allowed to put you on detention. And in detention, you would like dig trenches, you would like slash grass,
mm-hmm.
you know, you would do like hard labor for like the school garden,
mm-hmm.
right? So it was a very much a corporal punishment kind
right.
of school.
Mm-hmm.
And when I entered, I remember that there was an incident where, and this is just to paint a picture of the kind of culture that existed.
Right.
There were toilet blocks. There were two toilet blocks. One was for the Form 1 to Form 4, and then the other one was for the A-level students. So in the Form 1 to Form 4 block for the boys, someone, excuse me, this is explicit, someone took a dump. And then they, instead of taking a dump in the toilet, they took it outside of the toilet.
Right.
Right. So when the, you know, the cleaners came in, of course, they were like not
shocked.
Touching the, yeah, they were not touching it.
Mm-hmm.
They told the A-level prefects that this is what has happened. Right. And this is also kind of illustrating how power works. You would maybe expect, oh, they're going to tell the teachers, or they're like, oh, let's tell the prefects.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they tell the prefects, the boy prefects, and then they come and they rally and gather all the Form 1s to Form 4 boys,
mm.
and they send us to the assembly hall. We get into the assembly hall, and then they are like, okay, so this is what has happened. Who did it?
Right.
Right.
Because someone's going to raise their hand in front of a crowd and say, I did it.
Of course. Of course. You know, someone's going to admit and be like, yeah, it was me. It's me. Like, girl. So they start with the Form 4s.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, Form 4s, do you know who did this? Right? Was it any of you? One of the Form 4s raises his hand. And also just, you know, I'm sure this is clear for many people, but just to be very explicit, the Form 6s are big guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they look like grown men.
Mm-hmm.
Form 4s are at that point where they're 16, they're growing to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And Form 1s are like 12 and 13.
Mm-hmm.
These are not the kids.
Yes.
Right? So this is the kind of landscape that's
yes.
happening here in
mm-hmm.
this room.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Form 4s are like, oh, well, you know, we've been here for 4 years and nothing like this has ever happened. So we don't know who it was.
Mm.
Definitely wasn't us because we've been using these toilets, right?
Right.
So the Form 3s come and then they say the same thing. The Form 2s come and then they say the same thing.
Mm.
Then it gets to the Form 1s, us. And they're like, so Form 1s, who is it? They literally interrupted like school.
Mm.
They told all our teachers that we need all the boys.
Mm.
And the teachers just let them go like, yeah, take them. So we went at this whole like,
and these are the prefects.
These are the prefects
running all of this.
This is running all of this. Mm-hmm. And this is like at 7 and 8 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Then they get to us. Of course, we say we don't know who it was.
Mm-hmm.
Then they say, you know what? Get in a circle. We get in a circle. Then they say, I want you to slap the person next to you on their face.
Wow.
And if you don't slap them hard enough, I will slap you and that person.
Wow.
This is our first term. We've just started.
God.
Then we start slapping each other. And then the guy says, the person who did it, you see how everyone is going through pain. You have to step up. Otherwise, we're going to continue slapping each other until someone says they did it.
That is psychological torture.
It is violent. It's violent physically, but it's also violent psychologically, right? It is torture.
Right.
This is the kind of thing where, in terms of the psychology of it, this is the kind of torture that actually our police do in Zimbabwe. You know, this is the kind of torture that makes people go quiet. This is the kind of torture that makes people be, you know, they just, in the face of power,
right,
they cower, right? Because of this kind of practice.
And there's spectacle made out of them.
Yes.
As well.
Yeah, everyone, there's imagine.
There's a shame to it. There's humiliation.
There's, and the form threes, form fours, form twos are watching. And of course they're laughing, they're snickering, right? We're stabbing each other, until, like, we all start crying. And we're like, no, it wasn't any of us. Then one of the prefects is like, you know what? Maybe you're right. Maybe it wasn't one of the form ones. Okay, everybody, line up against the walls, right? Everyone take a wall or take a part of a wall. Then he says, now I want you to pretend that this wall is a girl. And I want you to start, like, flirting with this girl. Whoever convinces me that this girl's into you, you can go.
Wow.
Girl? What are you going to say to a wall that's going to make a girl stop? Like,
how do you woo a wall? It's also, to me, what stands out in this is the ways that toxic masculinity shows up and is taught to you and is just, like, encoded in so much of this behavior, from the slapping each other to the, oh, let's objectify a wall. Really, you're...
Yeah.
What is going on? There's so much happening here that just is reproducing. And I think the parallel that you made with the police and the way that they punish, really, and the way that they exert power, it's really a microcosm. It's a microcosm of the ways that we learn to relate with power, with authority figures.
Yeah.
It teaches us our place in society. Dash and I were talking about this earlier in our conversation, just around the ways that in schools we will learn. He was telling me a story about waiting for Jacob Zuma when he was in his previous teaching post, and Jacob Zuma was supposed to speak at the school, and he and the students sat out in the sun for 4 hours waiting. And they just had to wait and wait and wait. At some point, they decided to leave, and as they're leaving, he arrives. And this idea that this is a powerful person, so you have to wait for them. Your time doesn't matter as much. Your agency is beside the point.
Yes.
The powerful person is coming, you have to wait. And in school settings, I think there is that kind of culture as well, where we teach our students to just sit down, listen, wait, only do things when they're instructed to do them, even if it's against their will and even if it's not in the realm of their self-care, if it's bad for them. Like, it's like, oh, the teacher said it, therefore you have to do it. The prefect said, slap your friend, therefore you have to do it.
Exactly. And I think one of the core tenets that I'm hearing as well, and that which you're making me think about, that was present in the school culture, particularly when I entered, was the fact that you had to wait, which also meant that respect for a person was earned, right? It was earned in the waiting.
Right.
What gets you through being a Form 1 is knowing that for only two more terms, I'm a Form 1. And then when I'm a Form 2, you have to respect me. But what that means is we are not looking at each other as people who deserve respect just by mere fact of existing.
Right.
Right? Who deserve respect just by mere fact of we are beings. Right? It's that I have had to suffer. Right? So I must be respected for the suffering I endured. Therefore, you must endure suffering too. Right. Right? And when we think about, or when I think about Zimbabwe, or even what that looks like post school, is that people are taught that you have to find a way to get to the top no matter the consequence. Mm-hmm. Because when you get there, it's your time.
It's your turn.
It's your turn.
It's your turn.
It's, you know, there's a book that's called It's Our Turn to Eat, and it's about Kenyan politics. Mm-hmm. And this book is actually banned from Kenya because it exposes the idea of how certain people in certain like ethnic groups get into power, and then they get people who are in the same ethnic group into power, and they mm-hmm. say, you know what, it's our time now.
Yep.
And I think for high school, when I was in high school, when we got to form two, we're like, nah, it's our time now. The form ones are coming, you know, we'll be making them like carry the bags of the seniors, we'll be telling them to go get us seconds, we'll be doing all these things because that's what we were made to do.
Right.
And it's no longer the fact of, was it right? Mm-hmm. Right? Was it okay that we were being made to do these things? It's, no, we survived.
And they also, as a rite of passage, have to suffer the same thing.
They must suffer. Did. Yeah. Yes, I was crying. Yes, maybe I was like peeing my bed when I went back to, you know, to sleep. Maybe I'm a little insecure, broken, but it's okay. I'm gonna break someone else. And that is literally that culture of waiting, right? I'm going to break someone else because they must know.
Right.
And I think I remember when I got to form six, then I became also this idea of cheating the system. Mm-hmm. I think you're really taught at my school. You really had to learn what your thing was. And you had to learn how to build an image around yourself to protect yourself and also to gain leverage. Mm. So for me, I realized that because I liked school and because that my socks were always up, my uniform was always the right way, you know, teachers looked at me and said I was disciplined, right? I was a quiet student. And in these kind of schools, being quiet is...
rewarded.
Is rewarded.
Yes.
It is correlated with, you know, this is a good person.
Yes.
Because what we're teaching is deference, right?
It's deference.
It's don't question. Mm-hmm. It's just take it as it is. Mm-hmm. And I was that kind of student. I was quiet, did my homework, put my head down, and then teachers started to like me. So then I gained the trust with teachers. To the point that when we were in Form 4, we were being taught by the vice principal and he taught us mathematics. And then I had a friend who, his image was different, complete polar opposite. Mm-hmm. He was viewed as like naughty, and we were desk mates. He was viewed as naughty, he didn't do his homework, he was an B average student, right? Mm. And so the teachers just thought he wasn't taking himself too seriously. He wasn't disciplined. You know, he could do more, but he just wants to be with girls. You know, that narrative. And so our teacher leaves and then he says to the class monitor, he's like, write the names of people who talk when I come back and I'll take those people and I'm going to punish them.
The noisemaker list.
So this girl... bless her. I still think about the story until this day. So he leaves, and then my friend and I, who's my desk mate, we start laughing, he's cracking jokes, I'm cracking more jokes, it's like pandemonium. And the class monitor is like, guys, please keep quiet, no, 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 no. No one is listening. Mm-hmm. We're having a good time. Of course, you know, our names are on the noisemaker list.
Mm-hmm. Times 2000.
Listen. So he comes back and then he's like, please give me the list. Then the list is handed over. He continues teaching. At the end, he's like, I'm going to call everyone one by one to my office. And then the boys are going to get caned and the girls are going to do this kneeling thing that I was telling you about on the stones. Mm. So he calls me in and then he says, Keith, I'm surprised your name is here. And for context, I had never been caned, right? Because I've built an image of who I am. Mm-hmm. The boys who got caned and didn't care used to wear like 3 or 4 shorts underneath their actual shorts. Mm-hmm. So even if you
caned... books and...
So even if you caned them, they would act as if it was painful, but it's not as painful, right? And my friend was one of those guys.
Right.
But I didn't do that. Because that's not who... I was perceived to be, mm-hmm. even though I was very chatty. So, I walk in and he says, Keith, I'm very surprised, and I'm only having my one short. He's like, Keith, I'm very surprised to see your name here. And then I said, my name is there? And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, ah, sir, you know me. I was even practicing mathematical problems when you left. Yes, people were talking, but I was just really trying to prepare for a test. I'm very surprised my name is there. And he's like, ah, what happened? Then I was like, ah, but sir, you know, I really don't mean to do this. And you know, I never really complain about anything. But the girl who's the class monitor, she doesn't like me. And I don't know what's wrong. I have tried to like reach out. And you know, we always say in like, you know, in Christian faith that you should extend, you know, a leaf to everyone. And I really tried, but maybe it's because, so the girl used to like to sing and she didn't really like math. I was like, maybe it's because, you know, whenever I'm trying to like do homework, she's wanting to sing. I don't know. But this is really shocking for me. But you know what? If you want to cane me, sorry, that's okay. But
I You're really tapping into some serious acting skills.
Listen, survival, right?
Survival.
It's survival. Because survival. I was like, am I going to get six of the best?
No.
And then cry, no. Then go back?
Not on my watch. You said not today.
And then he's like, you know what? That doesn't sit well with me. And I just want you to focus on your test.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go back to class.
To being perfect.
But please call the monitor.
Mm.
Then he called the monitor. And he ripped her a new one.
Wow.
He was like, I trusted you. This is not a small job. Like, we're trying to put discipline. And you are coming after the people who are actually modeling what we're trying to do at this school. She ended up being punished.
Wow.
I went to the gravel. And it's not something I'm proud of.
Right.
But it is something that for me in that moment, I felt like I had to do.
Right.
To want to escape and not be caned. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think this is kind of the problem with systems like this, is they really just make you think about yourself and yourself only.
Right.
And no one else matters.
Right.
It's, I don't care about you, not in the sense of like, you know, literally maybe in that sense of as long as I'm okay and I will do whatever it takes to protect me.
Right.
And unfortunately, I've met people in adulthood who still carry that sentiment, right? Who still have really internalized that idea of it's me first and I'm going to stab and step and trick and put in harm's way anyone. There's no line for me as long as it means that I'm okay. Right? And in a country like Zimbabwe where there's so much scarcity, there's so much lack, imagine what that does to people.
Right.
Imagine the kinds of like unkindness and cruelty that people dole out to each other on a day to day, because for them it was either going to be you're eating or I'm eating. There's not enough of both.
And when I'm eating, it's my time now.
It's my time now. So it's just I play the game better.
Mm.
Right? And I think what I have done with distance from that time is try and say that there is another way to do it. Right, I think there is another way to make our students motivated.
Right.
I think there is another way to hold our students accountable. I think there is a different way that we can have a conversation with students about what it means to prioritize the important things at that time.
Mm.
Which I'm sure is what our teacher was trying to do when he left and he went to the office. He's like, practice what we are learning. Talk about this with a friend. Don't use this time to like chit chat because we're going to exams, right? I understand that, but how you make sure people do that in secondary school was very cutthroat, right? It was so authoritarian that it really made you only see you and not other people for people.
Mm.
And also it made you always think about how can I get a step up?
Right.
How can I ingratiate myself with power? So that I can always have someone I can lean on, you know? And I remember if you had a brother who was older or a senior, or a sister who was older or a senior, you know, my friend, the one I mentioned, he had an older brother, and life was so different for us because of his brother. Because
you had that protection.
We had the protection.
And particularly because it's also an older male figure, which is... you know, patriarchy doing its thing in that space of legitimizing power, and then whoever is affiliated with the patriarch is taken care of, essentially.
Yeah, and I also saw it play out with my friends who were girls, right? Mm. In the sense of the pretty girls, the pretty girls were safe, right? And in a very, you know, uncomfortable way, they were safe with teachers, and they were also safe with prefects.
Mm.
Because the male teachers, when I look back, used to say things to girls that were very... Now I look up and, you know, considering I teach now, that would be like harassment, you know?
Absolutely.
They would say things about, oh, yeah, yeah, you look good in that skirt today. You really ironed it. Or, you know, like... Ah,
yeah. Phew. Coded ways of...
Yeah.
Communicating their objectification.
Mm.
I have a memory of being... really, really young, and I know that I was younger than 7 years old because it's when my family lived in Blantyre, and we moved to Lilongwe when I was seven. And this was at the primary school that I was, it was my first primary school in Blantyre. And we had a teacher, I'll call him Mr. N, and he was notorious for caning students. Like, everybody was afraid of him and was on their best behavior around him because he would, he used to use these pipes, these white pipes to cane you. So many times they would break as his caning students, and he would like grab another piece and just like keep going. And very often he would select a wife in the classroom. He would just say, week you are my wife, you are safe. So even if you were making noise that whole week, because you're his wife, you are safe. And just the, this is another thing also, that the how pervasive, and this is not something that's unique to the African continent, I think it's everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that it's important for us to have these conversations. I know that, was it last year or the year before, BBC came out with the, the Sex for Grades documentary that exposed the things that we know. We know these things happen in universities.
Yeah.
We know these things are rampant, but I think especially at the secondary school level and even primary school level, I don't know that we've had, we have this conversation, because that looks different. It looks like it's minors. It's people really using violence in order to groom children. Because why are you, a man in your 30s, talking about someone who is 5 or 6 years old as your wife, as your spouse? What is that? And why does it have a place in the classroom? And I think when I reflect about it, sometimes it's a question of the fact that teaching as a as an occupation is very, very undercompensated. It's hardly ever anyone's first pick for a job. If you, if a child says, when I grow up I want to be a teacher, it's like, please, can you aspire towards something else?
Yes, try again.
Brought to you, maybe like lawyer,
banker. I just want to be an accountant.
Like, accountant. I remember when my brother was like really little and you'd ask him what he wanted to be. He wanted to be those people who held the umbrellas for the president. And my mom said, not on my watch. But anyway, the idea that, that teaching is undercompensated. It many, many teachers end up being teachers. It's not, and this is not everyone, of course. For some people, it is something they aspire towards. But I think that it, the street cred, if so to speak, of teaching is such that so many people don't want to be there. And then they end up there because of circumstance, and then they are just not meant to teach. And they, and then... the teacher as a figure of power and authority. I wonder, I'm very curious to know, like, what kinds of personalities that attracts. Because when I think of someone like Mr. N, he just seemed very power hungry. He just seems very narcissistic in the way that he operated in the classroom. When the classroom should be about the students and their learning and their growth and their enrichment, it was about him and how much he knows more than us, and like how he's, it, there was also this culture of shame where, ah, oh, how can you not know that? You know, like, and as someone who was a high-achieving student, I was safe. In the same way you're talking about, like, people's beauty protecting them. My brains protected me, where it's like, oh, I do well, and I'm never shamed for not knowing anything because I work hard and I know the things that I'm supposed to know. But I just also imagine what that did for students who didn't have that experience, who struggled, who had learning disabilities that went undiagnosed, unchecked, who had traumatic home environments that informed how they showed up in the classroom, who were not comfortable in English. This is another thing. Like, one of the things we were punished for in my school was speaking vernacular.
Oh my God, same!
Like, yes. There was a big sign in the front of the school that said English only. And like, when you are comfortable in Chijewa and now you're at school, suddenly they're speaking to you in this language that you... So, and then you're being assessed on this, and then you're being shamed, and it, slowly you just learn to shrink back and just like, you know your place. You're number 65 in a class of 66 and you're it's published in front of the whole school. Like, all those ways of shaming people, of like teaching them their place, which, like you were saying, carries over into how people show up in the world. And if you spend your entire life being told you're number 65 out of 66, how are you going to show up into the world, like, thinking anything of yourself? And then if you go into a place where people do think something of yourself, you're like, it's my time. I suffered all those years. I suffered for 19 years.
Literally.
It's time for me to shake my ass on a yacht in Dubai.
You are really preaching to the choir on a lot of levels, and I'll try to cover some of it, right? And I think the first thing I think about is that what I'm hearing from you and experiences I had similar in terms of, like, publishing who's first, in terms of, like, you know, being shamed if you don't know something, or not being shamed if you know something, is we are taught from a very young age that your worth as a human being is in what you can do.
Right.
And I think it's a spectrum. For some of us, we were told you are good because you are getting A's, right? You are good because you know how to speak in English well. You know how to write in English well. And then some of us were told you are not good because you don't know how to speak in English well. You don't know how to do arithmetic.
Right.
You don't understand biology or like social science. Therefore, you are not worthy as a person.
Right.
Which, to me, is nonsensical, because I think people have... We're multifaceted,
right?
And there are some things that I excel in. Like, when I was in high school, English and biology were my thing. Like, and everything else I was still good at, but anything about you couldn't tell me anything. But then there was a kid I remember who also was like a bully, but for now let's pause on that. But I remember that he was an athlete and he was really, really good at sports. He was the kind of student where he could watch someone play a new sport and then he would just pick it up so quickly. And then if he just played for a week, you would have thought that he was played for a year. He was a talented athlete. But because at my school, and by extension in Zimbabwe, everyone knew that being good in athletics wasn't going to pay any, like, future dividends, right, to you. And also, which is interesting, to your family, right? Because I think the other thing about education, at least for me when I was growing up, it was so tied to, like, family success.
Right.
Right? It's not just you. And I remember from a very young age realizing that, oh, the stakes are not just about me. It's about, like, this family.
Right.
It's about the reputation of the family. It's about the financial success of this family. So there was a lot of pressure to be able to succeed in one particular way. But what I understand now as a teacher is my students are talented and gifted in different things.
Absolutely.
Some of them are so talented in understanding how the way language works and the way language operates, particularly English, right? Some of them are really talented artists, as in they can draw and paint and sing. You know, like, there are other things that they may not show up in the metric of how I'm supposed to assess how they're doing in a particular subject, for example, English. But they're brilliant mathematicians, right? And brilliant, like, physicists. But we're not just talking about physics in my English class, and that's the only thing.
Mm.
But we didn't think like that when we were in school. It was that goodness, right, and worthiness was that you were doing well in school.
Yes.
And then now something that I have encountered, particularly in my teaching career, is this idea of learning ability connected to, you know, like mental health.
Right.
And that there are students, you know, my best friend, we've known each other for years, and only recently, and also comes from a similar schooling system, secondary school system,
mm.
only recently was learned that she had, like, a mental disability
mm.
that actually impacted how she learns,
mm.
right? And for years, all her teachers have just been like, oh, she's lazy,
mm.
she sleeps in class, she doesn't listen, she doesn't pay attention, you know, all these things.
Mm.
Meanwhile, this student has a learning, like, a bit, like they have a learning disability that you could help them in
mm.
that needs particular attention. And I now, as a teacher, every time I encounter a student and they're presenting particular behaviors,
mm.
I don't say this behavior is who the student is.
Mm.
I ask myself, where is this coming from?
Mm.
Right? Why is this pattern presenting in itself? Is itself in this way? But when I was in school, if you were sleeping or falling asleep, if you were just not understanding your concept fast enough. Also, this is back in the day when teachers were writing on the chalkboard,
mm-hmm.
right? No.
And if you cannot write, right,
yeah,
enough,
if
they
you
would
erase
keep up,
it. And they would erase it and it's gone.
And you can eat their chalk dust.
Like, you
yeah.
know what I mean? And no one is asking. And I think what you're saying is no one is centering your experience
nope.
in the classroom, right? Everyone is the power figure has arrived in class.
Right.
And I remember how classes used to feel so different between the women who were teachers and the men who were teachers, right? This story you're talking about, Mr. N. Like, I remember the men, particularly the male teachers, they wanted also to dominate the class through violence.
Mm.
And the boys who their voices were deeper or were tall or presented any kind of masculinity were the ones who were often in trouble with the men who were teaching.
Because
right?
they were a threat.
They were a threat to this man's space.
Mm.
And you know, the thing about it is I think it's all connected. You know, if you, like, stay with me for a little bit, right? If you are a man, right, in a patriarchal society,
mm.
and you know that the figures that are most powerful are men like you.
Mm-hmm.
However, you find yourself in a profession that is not as respected, you are not paid as much,
right.
which also means your ability to quote unquote provide is limited,
mm-hmm.
right? So in most of the spaces you encounter with your peers, you are probably someone who's being looked down upon,
mm.
right? So you're probably someone who's being reminded of their place,
mm-hmm.
as in your place is lower,
mm-hmm.
right? When other men interact with you at the beer hall, or when you're in a combi or taxi,
right.
or when you're at a family gathering, probably no one is calling on you to say, oh, what should we do? Because they know you don't have the money. So
mm.
therefore, you don't have a right to speak,
mm-hmm.
right? But then now when you're in a classroom with people who are younger than you, right, who don't have, of course, because they're a student, as much access or money or power, you are now going to take all your resentment out onto them.
Mm.
And you're now going to want to make yourself feel all the things that
you
can't
you wish
feel.
You could feel.
Exactly,
mm-hmm.
girl. So that's why I think some of those men were the way they were.
Mm.
And for me, interestingly enough, even though I was like a good student, I also was an early bloomer.
Mm.
So that meant my beard started to like come out very quickly.
Mm.
And going through puberty, if I shaved, like close shaved my beard,
mm.
I would like react. And
right.
I would have so many ingrowns and
mm.
it was not
cute.
No. But my teachers didn't care. I remember one teacher, I had left my beard only for a week. So it was very much like a stubble. It wasn't grown out at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember he walked up to me and he said, ah, so you think you're a man now? Yeah. You think you're a man now with your beard? And I was like, no, it's because like I'm reacting and it's actually so painful and almost close to impossible to shave at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to wait for the ingrowns to like go away so I can shave again. Then it's like, yeah, if I see you again like that, I'm going to take you and lash you. And the lashing was always in public, right? Because I need to remind you that you are not man.
Mm-hmm.
You are not, or at least man enough. You are not all this big person you think about.
Mm.
And people still do that. That kind of demeaning. You know, like you demean other people to feel better about yourself.
Yeah.
You need to like put people down. And that was so strong in our school culture. Yeah.
You know, I really just... I'm so grateful that we're having this conversation because I think it helps me take stock of why I feel so strongly about my students. And, you know, I think one of the things I've observed is that when they come to us, so many of them have come from these kinds of contexts.
Mm-hmm.
I notice just how, you know, I've told you about the Zimbabwean boy bow. Like,
yes.
The Zimbabwean boys that I teach who have come from boys' schools, when they come, they call me ma'am.
Mm.
They will, if I call them, there's this fear. If I just like call out to them and I say, you know, so-and-so, and they walk up to me, there's this like trepidation. It's like they expect like that they're in trouble.
Mm.
I'm like, no, I'm just saying hello, how are you doing? And then it's like, oh, I'm good, ma'am. And then there's a hand on the chest and the little bow that they'll do. And I'm like, these kids were taught to worship their teachers and to kiss their feet and to just move through life being perfect beings and not making mistakes. And if they do, then they are shamed for it for the longest. And I think just hearing you speak now, even about like things that were out of your control as a child, really, as someone who is just like growing into his body, your beard is coming in and you are shamed even for that. And you are taught that even the way that your body is operating is wrong. I'm thinking of, I remember when I was in primary school, I went to this primary school that it didn't have a high school, so it was just a primary school. So when you finished, you left, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the oldest age in the school was probably like 10 or 11 as a result. And then one day, one girl, I'll call her B, got her period. And they called an assembly for all the girls in the two highest grades.
Oh my God.
And they said, some of you have grown up, and those of you who have know what we mean. But we want to just give you this, and these were women also, so it's interesting, like women as, you know, a safe space in some senses, but also as an agent of patriarchy in some ways. Because I remember the teacher saying, those of you who've grown up know what we mean, and those of you who haven't, you'll find out. And it was so vague to me because I'm like 9, 10, and I'm like, I know what's going on. Like, I'm taller. Like, what are we talking about? It's so coded. And then they said, so as people who are growing up into women, you have to be careful because people's husbands work here.
Oh,
I'm 9.
No.
I'm 9 years old.
Oh, that's gross.
Like, and it took me years to understand.
Oh my God.
What they were talking about. Like, I was like, okay, people's husbands work here, and then what? What? Like, it was so just strange to me. And so I think what you're talking about like the body changing, how that's communicated to students, and how gendered that communication is. For you, it's your beard is a threat to me and my male ego. For me, it's your body is a temptation to the like male teacher's gaze. I'm so young, I don't know what this means. You're so young, you're like, I don't want these razor bumps or like ingrown hairs. Like, and yeah, I'm just again like grateful because I think that to be able to teach, I started off saying that it's one of the most like thankless, undercompensated things, but it's really just been such a privilege to undo some of that damage for students and to like watch the bow slowly fade away and sometimes remain, but not in the same kind of not from a place of fear. To see my students challenge and like speak back and protest and really just assert themselves in ways that you know, many of their school systems taught them not to do. To think of the classroom as a site for like joy and like learning and liberation and freedom, and to also as a teacher have moments where I'm being corrected by my students and like be able to say you're right and I am wrong and you've taught me something today, which I think has been super super important for me as well. I've had several moments like those where my students are like, Miss T, actually, that's not correct. I remember I was teaching a class and we're discussing the Arab Spring, and I started the story with Egypt and Tahrir Square, and I had a Tunisian student who raised her hand and she said, no, actually, Miss T, it started with the self-immolation of Mohamed Bouazizi in Tunisia. And I said, yes, of course it did. Like, I had forgotten that. Because, like, for me, the Arab Spring was something, like, I experienced when I was a student. And there was this Egyptian kid who was, like, literally not going to class and standing outside holding a big sign saying there's a revolution happening. And for me, like, that was my introduction to the Arab Spring. And in planning that class hastily, I had learned about this. I knew about Mohamed Bouazizi, but I just hadn't taken enough care to start the story where it began. I mean, Mohamed Bouazizi also, we can trace the story even further back. But anyway, like that moment was huge for me. And I was like, you are right and I am wrong. And I'm sorry for like starting this story in this way. Like, and to be able to do that and to have that space, it's such a privilege.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really love listening to you tell that story. And, you know, I have a friend of mine who does this, like, dinner party trick question where he asks people that, you know, out of all the teachers that you've had, can you count on your fingers the ones that were good to you or the ones that you enjoyed being in their class? And we went to many a party together, and he would always get the most, I remember, at least him telling me, is like six.
Wow.
Six fingers.
In a lifetime.
Yeah.
Of teachers.
In a lifetime of teachers, right? And we are going to parties where we were meeting people from all over the world. And people from, like, Europe, well, you know, Western Europe, Eastern Europe, like, the U.S., African continent, South America, or you name it. And six?
No.
And I think about the story you're telling me, right, about your student, and I think what it teaches us is that learning is not unidirectional.
Nope.
Right? Learning does not happen because of your age. Learning is a continual process that hopefully we are all doing every single day. You know? And even one of the things I like to do, because I remember when it happened for the first time, it really shocked me. So, you know, I've mentioned I went to secondary school in Zimbabwe. And then for 2 years of my life, I went to a boarding school in Johannesburg. And one of my history teachers said in our class, we were talking about something and someone asked a question. And then she said, oh, I don't know. Do you mind, like, going and, you know, looking it up, and I'll go find out and then we can come back and discuss it? And I remember when it happened, I was like, what? She doesn't know? And she's asking the other person to go also look for it? Because for us, the teacher is omniscient, you know? The teacher is all-knowing. The teacher is never wrong, infallible, right? And for me, I had really, 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 really internalized that to the point where if I got something wrong, it wasn't because the teacher hadn't explained it well. It wasn't because the teacher had, you know, maybe not taken enough time for us to sit with it. It was because I had done something wrong.
Right.
I hadn't studied hard enough. I hadn't practiced enough. You know, it was always my fault, right? At the end of the day, it wasn't about the teacher. And hearing my teacher say that in class for the first time really made me think, oh, there is, we both have a stake in this.
Mm.
You know, like, we are both showing up here. We are both, you know, we don't all know it all.
Right.
And I think when I'm in class, even today, you know, we're reading fiction and it's very exciting. And as, even as a practice, I read stories with my students that make them feel a little uncomfortable. Like today we were reading a queer story called Until It Doesn't by Roy Ubaka, who's Nigerian.
Mm.
And in the story, it's about these two queer men, J and K, who fall in love and then go through life from the time they're 15 to the time they're in their 60s.
Mm.
And we just track them, right? Mm. And it's very, like, cinematic in terms of how you're reading it. It almost feels like it's voyeuristic in a way. You're watching them. Very, like, PG-13
mm.
kind of, you know, stories. Yeah. But for my students to be able to read those stories out loud with each other and with me in the room.
Mm.
And to say that this is not something we are going to, first of all, feel ashamed
mm-hmm.
for and say, no, just read by yourself and pretend like it didn't happen. No. And secondly, this is also something that we are going to explore together, right?
Right.
And when we start discussing and my students ask a question, I always say, you know what? What do other people think? And someone will say something, I'll be like, you know what? I'm going to write that on the board.
Yes.
Right? Because it's not only my voice in my class that should be heard.
Mm.
When I think back to my teacher in that class, I remember her saying, I don't know. And today, a student asked me, you know, like, oh, is this like omniscient or is this like omnipresence? And I said, you know what? I actually don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And let's go look it up and we'll come back to class. And for sure, we'll come back to class and we'll be like, actually, it's this.
Right.
Right. And I think for me, one, it shows me, like, you know what? In as much as I love the English language, I may just never, ever have it all within me.
Mm.
And that's okay.
Right.
And also, I'm always going to continue learning because my students are teaching me as well.
Mm.
And I wish that it happened to me earlier.
Mm.
Right. And I'm grateful that it did happen to me when it did. But I also wish it had happened to some of my friends who never had that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then imagine you walk into work and you don't have this experience of knowing that someone who is an authority figure can be wrong,
mm-hmm.
right? And a mistake happens and you did everything.
Mm-hmm.
But because you're junior, because you're starting out, you are immediately going to say, oh, it must have been me.
Mm-hmm.
It could not have been my boss
mm-hmm.
because my boss has been here for so long. My boss is infallible,
mm-hmm.
right? And this is what we're teaching
right.
young minds.
Right.
And you're like, no. That's not what happens, but it is what, this is how it plays out.
Mm.
Bosses will just say, yeah, it was the junior. Yeah, doesn't know what she's doing that one.
Yeah.
You know, everyone will be like, yeah.
Mm.
And you're like, no, it's because you are comfortable in your position.
Yeah.
You are sloppy. You are sloppy and you're not learning.
Mm-hmm.
You're not pushing yourself. That's why probably this mistake happened. But what you're saying about your students pushing back is no one has taught you to push back.
Mm-hmm.
No one has taught you to push back in a way that is, you know, generative. No one has taught you to push back in a way that is collaborative. You've just been taught to be deferent.
Mm.
So when your boss says, yeah, there's no way I could make this mistake. I've been at this job for 15 years. You know, again, it's the boy is saying, we've been here for 4 years. It was not us. We used the toilet like that, right?
Yeah.
And then you're like, yes, boss. And it's so colonial.
It's
as
so
well.
Colonial.
You know, it's very much like we have a culture in Zimbabwe because we're a settler colony. We have a culture of like garden boys and like, you know, houseworkers.
Yes.
You know,
boys' quarters.
Boys' quarters. We literally have
mm-hmm.
houses that's
giving
so
Malawi.
You know, and when the dynamic of that, I think sometimes is replicated in our schools,
mm.
right? Where the white master, right? Or the white boss, will tell you, I want you to do this and this and this and this. You don't know anything.
Mm.
Right. And also the idea of respect and dignity,
mm-hmm.
your humanity is stripped away from you
mm-hmm.
because in this kind of system and context, you've been systematically, we will not even consider that, right? Not allowed to be even sure if you can offer anything,
mm-hmm.
but because you can't, Therefore, I'm not going to respect you mm-hmm. or treat you as a human being. Mm-hmm. I'm going to treat you as subhuman, and I'm going to treat you as a child. Yes, right? It's also infantilizing.
You're infantilizing yeah. the language of garden boy. When
boy, you're a man, 70 years old.
And you're staying at the boys' quarters. And it is like part of the, you know, colonial infantilization of black people.
Yeah.
Forever a boy, forever a girl. And therefore forever subordinate.
Mm. And the fact that our schools institutionally replicated it.
Yeah.
Right. And I think, I even think about what we're talking about our bodies. Think about how our bodies were very colonized. They were a site where colonization is. There was every colonization is playing out.
Yeah.
Right. Because at least for my school, in the school that I was telling you about, these were the things that are expected of the boys.
Mm.
Right. Just listen to it. You have to be close shaved if you had a beard. You had to have a clean cut in terms of your hair.
Mm-hmm.
So like military style, like buzz cut, like nothing. It should be, you know, very, very low cut.
Mm-hmm.
That's for the boys. The girls, you weren't allowed to relax your hair. You also were, no. You weren't allowed to keep your hair in an afro. Because it was unkempt. It was messy. You had to either relax your hair, cut your hair like the boys. You weren't allowed braids.
Mm-hmm.
Because the braids made you think that now you are a
you've
girl.
Arrived.
You are a girl who's seeking attention of the boys and the men.
Mm.
Your skirt, right, was supposed to be like knee length. Right, and even for the boys, it was supposed to be like right up till your just above an inch above your knee,
mm-hmm.
right? And there were so many things that really what we're telling you is we want you to be closer to being white,
mm-hmm.
or we want you to take away the things that remind us of your blackness.
Mm.
And I was like, what the hell? Because I'm not the one who said my beard should start growing when I'm 14. I did not do that. And it's one, it's growing out of me. I'm not, like, that's not, I can't control that.
Through no effort of my own,
literally. And two, how does that affect my ability to learn?
Literally.
In any way, right? Or, I don't know how you feel about this, and I'm curious to know your thoughts about, like, the guidelines of, like, how a girl is supposed to show up in school, but how does you having an afro affect how you are learning in a class? If anything, it's only what it's doing is it's reminding us and it's signifying that you are of black descent and African descent, and that is what's going on with your hair.
Yep. You're being black a little too loud. Maybe whisper your blackness. And you know what you're saying about the body, you know, the school's relationship to the body, even when we think of corporal punishment, there's an entitlement to your body. There is the use of your body as a tool for, like, to incite compliance.
Mm.
Through punishing your body, then will get you to comply, to obey.
Mm.
Not because you understand why you should do certain things, but because you are afraid of what will happen to your body if you don't do those things. And I'm even thinking of, now I'm thinking of dress codes and also like the way that they're gendered and how there is such an emphasis on the length of skirts and the thickness of straps and how much should be hidden
mm-hmm.
on the female body or bodies that are gendered as female, and how much should be orderly in bodies that are gendered as male, and things like even hair, no dreadlocks or unkempt hair, that sort of thing. Like,
mm-hmm.
and it's like, where are we? Are we in the Caucasus Mountains? I'm grateful because you intuitively went to thinking about how your experiences in school have informed you and how you show up as a teacher, which those are questions I was going to ask you, but you answered them. So, yeah, I don't know if you have any last thoughts that you would like to share.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my last thought is, this is a question that I haven't really answered, is how I came into teaching and how I think about it now.
Right.
I think that before, I wasn't intending on being a teacher. I was interested in education and was actively in the education field or space. And then this found me, is how I would describe it, this opportunity to teach. But I remember I was talking to, you know, an ex, and I was saying, I don't really want to, like, I don't want to teach, you know, I don't be in a classroom with, like, teenagers. I don't know if this is, like, what I want to do. And my experience, I remember saying, and my experience was not a great one, right? And I was like, I don't, that doesn't, it is really bringing up a lot of hurt and pain for me. Particularly also because something I haven't touched about in this is being like a man who is effeminate in this kind of school system was very difficult. And I was like, I don't want to go back to that. And then he said, you know, what about the teachers you liked? You know, what was it that you enjoyed about those teachers? And then I started gushing about, like, you know, the teachers I met when I was in boarding school. And I was like, you know, they really showed up. They did this, da-da-da-da. Interestingly, there were, like, literature and English teachers.
Of course.
shout out to all the literature and English teachers.
Shout out to us.
Honestly. And then he said, and how do you feel now thinking about that experience? And, you know, I said then, I really, the only thing I want to do is just to be the teacher I wished I had. And I think that informs how I interact with my students. It informs how I listen to my students, how I co-create with them, how I listen to them. And sometimes, you know, they are bullshitting. And sometimes they are actually being truthful and honest and going through things, you know. And no one ever listened to me when I was having a difficult time. No one ever really saw that my mood has changed, that I'm not just the same way, and said, hey, like, what's going on? Are you okay? Right? And I think that is how I want to teach, and that is how I try to teach. And to say to my students, the ones who, you know, quantitatively are doing well, to see them and to appreciate them. But for the ones who are just there and maybe not always getting it, to develop a relationship with them outside of that subject.
Right.
So that they know that their worth is not dependent on how they're showing up in my class. Right? Whether you are having an A star or you are getting a C in my class, I will approach you with the same kind of, you know, care and kindness and patience. And I think that is what I hope more students experience. And that is what I hope, you know, more teachers who are coming of our age now are implementing in one way or the other in their classrooms. Because I think, particularly on our continent, we need more teachers who are just a bit more human. And of course are preparing us for the world, but are showing us that we can be different and that we can see other people for who they are and make not have that threat in our own existence.
Beautifully put. And as you were saying that, I think I was also just thinking of the six, you know, the six teachers who have, in spite of the undercompensation and the systems, who have, you know, held us down. There are not many, you know, like, but there are some, and there are people who, I think of my teachers, and they were all my English teachers. They were supportive, and they cared, and they were kind, and they were tender. And yes, they were not the majority, but they are there. So shout out to those teachers who exist, and who we honor, and who enable us to be kind to our own students, because we saw kindness in them and how they did things. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you for having me. I've been very honest.
What a rich conversation, and I'm sure so many people will find it meaningful.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, and good luck.
Yes.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Ufahamu Africa. You can find more episodes, show notes, and transcripts on our website, ufahamuafrica.com. This podcast is produced and managed by Megan DeMint, with help from production assistants Chukwufunanya Ikechukwu, Alex Kozak, and Ami Tamaklo. Our non-resident podcast fellows are Bamba Njaye, Maseke Rioba, Takona Priscilla Sempere, and Kamohelo Tunigo Toledi. We are generously supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and receive research assistance from Cornell University and the University of California, Riverside. Our music is courtesy of Kevin McLeod. Until next week, Safiri Salama.